You're listening to Grace Saves All, the podcast which exists at the spiritual intersection of Christianity and universal salvation. In this podcast, we will be exploring an ancient and modern approach to Christianity, which affirms both that grace saves alone and that grace goes to all. And now, here is David Artman, author of Grace Saves All, The Necessity of Christian Universalism.
I regard Dr. Ilario Remelli to be the world's leading expert in the study of patristics and early church history as it relates to Christian Universalism, or as it is sometimes called, the doctrine of apocatastasis. Dr. Remelli has provided us with an epic study of the place of Christian Universalism in the early centuries of the church, and her scholarly masterwork entitled The Christian Doctrine of Apocatastasis, A Critical Assessment from the New Testament to Erigena. This huge, nearly 1,000-page work is the ultimate academic resource for a detailed understanding of how the Christian hope of universal salvation developed in early Christianity. The word apocatastasis in the title refers to a Greek word found in Acts 3:21. Apocatastasis is often translated into English as the restoration of all things. Thankfully, there is now a condensed, more affordable, and in some ways updated version of Remelli's epic 1,000-page scholarly work. This shorter, condensed version of her scholarship is available now and in an incredibly helpful overview entitled A Larger Hope, Universal Salvation from Christian Beginnings to Julian of Norwich, published by our friends at Wittgenstock. I reached out to Dr. Remelli with a series of important questions about Christian Universalism, and she was kind enough to respond back to each of my questions in recorded form. Her health challenges did not allow for a normal interview process, so in each of these following episodes, you will hear her read the question or questions and then give her answers. Enjoy.
Answer 6, continuated. So MacLamon maintains that the Gnostic, I'm quoting, Kabbalistic and esoteric roots of Christian Universalism are evident. So now the Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, did influence some early modern Christian Universalists, that's for sure, but certainly it was posterior to the first systematization of Christian Universalism from Origen onwards. It has actually nothing to do with the patristic doctrine of apocatastasis, which is what I mainly study. So thus purported Kabbalistic and Zoroastrian origins, just as medieval Gnosis, have no bearing at all, say, on discussions of patristic apocatastasis. Our focus must be instead on MacLamon's claim about Gnostic origins. This can be a case, of course. So Origen certainly knew Gnostic ideas. Again, I say Gnostic in square, you know, scare quotes. The similar study by Holger Struthwohl, for instance. And of course, both Origen and most Gnostics shared some broadly conceived Platonic ideas applied to Christianity. But Origen was professedly anti-Gnostic, as is evident in all his extant writings, even in the recently discovered Munich homilies, the homilies that have been very recently discovered and then edited by Lorenzo Perrone and others. It's very interesting. Of course, they are only just homilies, it's not a big commentary, but it's very important. And even in this work, which is arguably a late work, we have a lot of anti-Gnostic polemics. It is mainly from the refutation, I would say, of the perceived main Gnostic tenets, especially the determinism coming from the division of humans into various natures, that Origen's grand theory of rational creatures, their fall and their restoration, so their apocatastasis, stemmed. It is precisely against Gnosticism, against the system, or what he perceived, of course, as Gnosticism, what Clement also perceived and others. Origen spent his life refuting what he deemed Gnostic tenets, such as predestination, Valentinian, Gnostic tenets such as predestinationism, different natures, different fuses, natures among rational creatures, and even among humans, and the separation between a superior god and an inferior demiurge, if not even evil demiurge, the severing of divine justice from divine goodness, docetism, the notion of eons as divine, and the whole Gnostic mythology, the refusal to interpret the Old Testament spiritually and the New Testament historically, and more. So Origen regarded Gnostic, again, is here quotes Platonism, as a bad Platonism, while he intended to construct, very probably it's what emerges from his thought, a kind of orthodox, again, also in scare quotes, orthodox Christian Platonism, not only against other non-Platonic philosophical schools and pagan Platonism, so against pagan Platonism, again, scare quotes, but also against what he regarded as the unorthodox Christian Platonism of Gnosticism. So his system, in a way, was built against these opponents. And Gnostics were surely opponents. They were opponents of Bardizon, they were opponents of Clement, they were opponents, and they were all, like Origen, they were supporters of apokatastasis and supporters of human free will. And also thought that universal restoration will be based on a voluntary adhesion to the good. I argued for this construction of Origen's orthodox Christian Platonism, so to say, seminal in the chapter on Origen in the book on apokatastasis, and I will support this interpretive line further in a work in preparation. So on Origen's on Gnostic theories of apokatastasis, after my preliminary work in Journal of Coptic Studies, where I tried to compare some examples of Gnostic theories of apokatastasis with Origen's theory of apokatastasis, further investigation is underway. What emerges is mainly, generally, broadly speaking, that Gnostics did not really believe in apokatastasis conceived as universal salvation. For instance, MacLean cites some Gnostic works such as The Origin of the World, The Apocryphon of John, Wisdom of Jesus Christ, and the Tripartite Tractate. Now, these works do not seem to support universal restoration, if you read them very carefully and compare them with the Christian support of apokatastasis, as I argued in a review and also in an appendix to my monograph A Larger Hope. So there is no discussion of chronology in the treatment of Gnostic treatises by MacLean, but anyway, Gnosticism, unlike most patristic supporters of apokatastasis, first of all, one, had mostly no holistic doctrine of apokatastasis. So holistic means involving the restoration of both soul and body, humans, such as the Carpocratians in Irenaeus' account, for instance, who maintained that only souls would be saved, and moreover supporting metensomatoris, or the doctrine of transmigration of souls. And two, so one is that, two, in most cases, Gnostics supported not really universal salvation, so for everybody, at least for every human and rational creature, but salvation only for a class, again, one so-called nature or class of human, the pneumatikoi, so the spiritual people, as they divided humanity, and part of the psychikoi, so the so-called animal, the people, those characterized by a soul, this is an inferior level, where the sarkikoi, so the carnal people, so of course this is terminology taken from Paul, but established very differently by the Gnostics in these classes, or perceived at least classes of human beings. the Sakikoi did not at all survive, so they are not absolutely entitled to salvation of any kind. There might be some exception, but generally speaking, this is the picture. So there's no holistic doctrine of apokatasi involving the whole human being, and also it does not involve all humans or even all rational creatures. These are the two big differences. So both these two points and Origen's lifelong anti-Gnostic polemic, I would say, undermine the hypothesis that apokatasi is a kind of spurious Gnostic theory rather than an authentic Christian patristic doctrine. So also it's very interesting the pattern of the fall and restoration of souls is common not only to Origen and the Gnostic, as MacLemon suggests, but also to all patristic Platonists, of course, including the anti-Manichaean Agasti, who speaks of creatures deficere, so fall, and their restoration by God. So more broadly, I would even say it is common even to all Christians who share the biblical story of the fall and believe in the restoration brought about by Christ. Of course, speaking of all Christians, for some, this is a universal restoration. For others, of course, it's only a partial restoration if they support the eternity of hell or an annihilation. Of course, I'm not entering then these two, but it's anyway a restoration, full or partial. So if one objects that the difference between Origen's and the Gnostics' fall and restoration of soul on the one side and the Orthodox Christians, again, scare quotes, on the other, lies in the resurrection of the body, included in the Orthodox account but excluded by the Gnostics and Origen, it must be observed that Origen sided more with Orthodox Christians than with the Gnostics regarding the resurrection. The account of pre-existent disembodied minds that fell into earthly bodies certainly parallels Gnostic myths, but it is not what Origen supported. That Origen denied the resurrection of the body is indeed a misconstruction, probably originated in his twofold conception of the resurrection, so of body and soul, and also mind. It's already threefold, actually, but then it was developed later by Evagrius into a resurrection, restoration of body, soul, and nous, the intellect. So that misconstruction cannot stand careful investigation, just as the supposition that he admitted of disembodied souls, that Origen would have admitted of disembodied souls. I think that there would be really much can be argued against this, and it can be shown that when Gregory of Nyssa criticized the preexistence of disembodied soul in a famous passage, he was not targeting Origen, who did not support it. Several studies I devoted to Origen's and Nyssa's anthropology indicate this, so suggest this very strongly. So most patristic supporters of apokatastasis, beginning with Origen and Nyssa, did not believe in metensomatoi, so in the transmigration of souls, and overtly refuted this doctrine. Metensomatosis is mentioned on two pages of MacLean, 129-63, as a core doctrine of patristic universalism coming from Gnosticism and linked with the tenet of the preexistence of bare souls to the body. 141 is the page of MacLean. But Origen and Nyssa, in fact, rejected metensomatosis very strongly, both of them, being both among the strongest supporters of apokatastasis. So we cannot absolutely say that this doctrine was linked. Then, of course, it became a kind of commonplace or something like a topos, and we have it even in Justinian, who actually had very, very little competence actually in what Origen really taught. But so we have this association between metensomatosis and apokatastasis later, but it's by on the part of people who did not know anything, practically very little, of Origen's thought, if any. anything at all. So, in fact, Origen and Nissen rejected Metensomaturis but embraced Apocatastasis. So there's not this connection between the two, but they wanted one and rejected the other. So likewise, Origen spoke only metaphorically, this must be said, of souls that can descend to the animal level. So not literally within a context of transmigration of soul. Sometimes some expressions of Origen have been misunderstood as literally speaking of metensomaten, and this is absolutely absurd. He's speaking metaphorically, speaking spiritually, like when he speaks of the spiritual death of the soul. In this sense, for instance, Origen states, is in commentary on Matthew and taken also in Pamphilus Apology, I quote, "Those who have, who are alien to the Catholic faith think that souls migrate from human bodies into bodies of animals." So he's very much against that. "On the contrary," he says, "we maintain that human wisdom, if it becomes uncultivated and neglected due to much carelessness in life," the carelessness is a terrible thing for Origen, insists everywhere on the importance of application, etc. So, of love, application, everything, and on the contrary, sluggishness, carelessness are terrible for Origen. Actually, they even brought about sin at the beginning. So, and even now. So, if it becomes uncultivated and neglected due to much carelessness in life, it becomes like an irrational animal. So, human wisdom becomes like an irrational animal. Efficito velut irrationabile pecus. This is commentary on Matthew. So, due to incompetence or neglectfulness, again, terrible sins for Origen, but not by nature. Per imperitiam, vel per negligentiam, but non per naturam, not by nature. And of course, so this issue was at stake in the interpretation of Plato's mentions of animals also. So whether to take it literally, whether to take it allegorically, metaphorically, symbolically, spiritually. So some took them as literal. Others, such as Cronius, for instance, one of Origen's favorite readings, by the way, according to Porphyry, as metaphorical expression of becoming animal. I am quoting here the report by Nemesius in De Natura Hominis, so the nature of human beings. So some interpreters, he say, took wolves, lions, and asses, or names of animals, literally, curios. But others deemed Plato to have been speaking metaphorically, tropikos, using animals to represent characteristics of the soul. Indeed, Cronius, in his work on palingenesis, which is metensomatosis, deems them all rational souls. End of quote. So this is very interesting. As a last point, very, very little, because this is just a very small point. It's connected to that. Maximus the Confessor is very, he's usually said to have rejected Origen. Actually, he rejected parts of Origenism. This is for sure Origenism, but Origen himself, not quite so. For instance, when Maximus at the beginning of his Ambiguum 7 criticizes those who posited an initial unity of rational being connatural with God, symphueis theon, this cannot target Origen, who explicitly denied instead against some Gnostics that rational creatures could be connatural homoousioi with God. I argued for that a lot in an article in Harvard Theological Review. So, this is just to counter, but mainly the idea that apokatastasis was a kind of spurious fruit of an encounter of Christianity with Gnosticism and even with Kabbalah. Speaking especially of patristic apokatastasis, this is what mainly shortly can be said. So question 7. If God has predetermined that all will finally be saved, then what about human freedom? Wouldn't God need to respect our freedom to damn ourselves forever, if that is what we truly want to do? So, this is a very important question, and we have always to distinguish an emic and an eric perspective. So, the perspective of what we intend, what we think about freedom, and the perspective of what the ancient Origen thought about freedom, Gregory of Nyssa thought about freedom, Evagrius, and Augustine with the development. And so we have to be very careful, because many wrong oppositions can arise from the confusion from these two perspectives, emic and eric. I have already spoken a little of the theology of freedom while discussing Christ as all virtues and his role in apokatastasis, when you asked about the role of Christ in apokatastasis, in the fundamental role of Christ. So we can surely argue that both Origen and Gregory of Nyssa, and also other patristic supporters of apokatastasis, regarded human freedom as fully compatible with divine providence. Actually, Origen is explicit on that. And also its outcome, so the outcome of divine providence, which is, in their view, universal restoration. They are theologians of freedom, from the emic perspective. In their view, free will is compatible with providence, which leads to universal salvation. Origen repeatedly expressed this compatibility. For instance, in the Principis 3.5.8, he says, God providentially takes care of everyone, respecting the free will of all logica, so of all rational creatures. So there is the pole of free will and the pole of providence, of divine providence. They work together. It's not that one cancels, erases the other. Rational creatures will adhere to God voluntarily. So this is the outcome of this theology of freedom of Origen. For instance, in the Principis 3.5a, Origen says, I'm quoting, all the world will submit to the Father, not by violence or necessity that compels to subjection, but by means of word, reason, teaching, imitation of the best, good norms, and even threats when appropriate. End of quote. So Origen elaborated his apokatastasis doctrine on the basis of his defense of free will, mainly, as I said earlier, against Gnostic determinism, or what he perceived as Gnostic determinism, as is clear from the whole of the Principis 3, Book 3, which begins with this defense within a concern for theodicy, the justice of God, and then ends up to theorizing apokatastasis. So, Origen starts from the defense of free will against the Gnostics and finishes, ends up with this theory of apokatastasis. So, it is the outcome of his anti-Gnostic polemic and of his defense of freedom. And this is also the same that happens in Bardizan of Edessa, a bit older contemporary of he, older, but the sources are later, so I'm not entering Bardizan now, but it's very interesting that we have exactly the same, I argue for, the parallels and pointed them out an article in Harvard Theological Review. So Origen and Gregory embraced ethical intellectualism, studying it a great deal, and it is really the key to dismantle the objection to apokatastasis based on human freedom, at least, again, from the emic perspective for the patristic supporters of apokatastasis. So ethical intellectualism is very basically a philosophical, ethical or metaethical doctrine, widespread in ancient philosophy and patristic thought, that regards moral choices as based primarily on one's intellect, nous, mens or intellectus animus, this is in the ancient languages, Greek or Roman. The faculty of will, on this interpretation depends directly on the intellect. Hence its name, ethical intellectualism, which is of course a modern term per se, but it speaks about what happened for these ancient, how the way they thought. So it means that ethical choices, and hence one's behavior, depend on the intellect. Origen of Alexandria, for instance, in fact, constructed, as I said, a kind of a Christian Platonism, patristic Platonism with marked Stoic and some Aristotelian influences. Origen expressed the basic principle of ethical intellectualism in the formula, and then in many other cases, not only this, but this in the formula is very pithy, sicutamente voluntas, will comes from the intellect. This is he puts it there like something very well known, something that everybody could agree about. This is a doctrine that was supported by the Stoics, the Roman Stoics, all. So it's very important. So that this statement and much other support of ethical intellectualism is by a patristic Platonist is not fortuitous. It is not chance, it's not by chance, for the theory of ethical intellectualism goes back to Socrates, at least as represented by Plato, and Plato himself. Then, of course, then the Stoics came in. Stoics who belong to a Socratic school of philosophy, of course, a Hellenistic Socratic school of philosophy, made the most of this theory and maintained that ethical failure is due to wrong judgment. So again, it goes back to the intellect, or it depends on the intellect. The good is only virtue, and evil is only vice. And the identification of virtue with the good is the quintessence of eudaimonism. Its link with ethical intellectualism lies in the tenet that ethical success is based on right judgments. That is to say, it depends on knowledge. Virtue is knowledge, essentially. So it descends from the intellect, it descends from knowledge. This is something very important. We have to remember this in order to interpret how they conceived of virtues, of ethics, and how they conceived of freedom. So in the perspective of ethical intellectualism, moral subjects can only love and choose the good. One chooses evil only if one, in fact, mistakes it for a good. So again, it's a mistake in the judgment, a mistake in the intellect, it's an intellectual mistake. Choosing a minor or apparent good, as Socrates and Plato stressed, I'm not quoting them now, but still. So the problem is indeed a wrong judgment, thus leading, so it's a lack of knowledge. Again, so no one, as I'm quoting Protagoras, said Plato, no one willingly goes towards evil or what one deems evil. No one willingly. So if you go towards evil, it's unwillingly. So this is Plato's definition. So the problem is this wrong judgment. Again. So what one deems evil is obviously a matter of knowledge. What I think is evil. Again, virtue is knowledge. If one knows what is good, one will choose it. This is Protagoras again, so it's Plato, but it's also the presupposition of all of Origen's doctrine of the return to God the good. If you know the good, who is God, of course, the supreme good, you will choose it. There's no way. You will choose it. First, you must know it and have a sight, an intellectual sight, that is not obnubilated, is not obfuscated, right? Is not blurred. So evil is chosen on account of a wrong judgment, a darkening or blurring of one's intellectual discernment. This is why whoever commits injustice or acts wrongly or sins, we can say in Christian perspective, does not do so really freely, but in fact out of ignorance. So again, freedom is for the good. if you go towards evil, you are not free. This is the point. Ignorance cannot be counted as freedom, but it is rather a lack of knowledge and thence of freedom itself, since one is free if one acts voluntarily in the awareness of what one chooses and does. So in Plato, ethical intellectualism is connected with the principle of theodicy and responsibility. Theodicy, as I mentioned earlier, is the justice of God, and Plato is the fountainhead of this doctrine, right? For all the time on philosophy, philosophical theology until now. So he says, that God, this is the tenet of Plato that would be repeated ad nauseam by Christian Platonists and even by many patristic, intellectuals. He says, God is not responsible for evil, because God is entirely good and does not cause any evil, as Plato claims in the Myth of Er. This is important in the Republic 10 book. He says, virtue has no master, arete de adeskoton. So the responsibility is with the one who makes the moral choice. God is not responsible. Aitia helomenu, theos anaitios. So the responsibility for one's action lies with each moral subject, so each human, each angel, right? But in order for one to make a choice and be responsible for it and accountable for it, one must make such a choice freely or voluntarily, which means knowingly. If one does not know, there is no freedom. So if one does not know what one is doing or is forced to do it, one cannot be regarded as responsible or accountable for it because there is a lack of freedom. This is clearly expressed, for instance, by the words attributed to Jesus of Nazareth in Luke, and later Jesus' follower Stephen in Acts 7:60, respectively. Of course, the New Testament is not exactly a philosophical, ethical treatise, but it reflects a lot. There's the beginnings of patristic philosophy are actually in the New Testament, besides being, of course, so in the New Testament, in Scripture, and besides being, of course, in ancient philosophy. So what does Jesus say? This is very famous. Father, he says on the cross, do not impute them this sin, the sin of killing him on the cross, since they do not know what they are doing. So again, the problem, the key point is knowledge. If they don't know, Jesus asks God the Father not to impute them this sin of killing him. The basically Platonic and Stoic heritage of ethical intellectualism is found again in patristic thought. In Irenaeus, so we have already said its in origin is prominent, but in Irenaeus, for instance, who saw what would be called the original sin as the result of deception and ignorance, immaturity. In Origen, who traced sin back to ignorance, claiming, for instance, among many, many other passages, I'm not going into them now, of course, but he claims that sin is rightly called ignorance in some scriptural passages. And he says scriptures, so the Bible does well to call sin ignorance. And also, especially in Gregory of Nyssa and Evagrius. Gregory of Nyssa, a great follower of Origen, although he, of course, has also his own novelties. But Gregory, an admirer of Origen, a patristic Platonist, even explained the sin of the protoplast, Adam and Eve, in the perspective of ethical intellectualism. This is exactly his explanation of the original sin. He says that Adam and Eve ate the forbidden fruit because it appeared good, it looked good, but in fact it was evil. So they were deceived in their judgment. Ethical intellectualism did not contemplate a really conscious rejection of the good. If one rejects the good, one is not really conscious, not really free. If one knows the good, one will choose it. Patristic supporters of apokatastasis thought that all will be purified and illumined, and will thus know God, the good, and therefore will choose to stick to it. And this will be apokatastasis. If all do so, this will be universal restoration. So Origen's theology of freedom is at the core of his Trinitarian theology, of his cosmology, of his anthropology, including his soteriology and eschatology. He placed at the center of these doctrines the concept of autexousion, the self-determining free will, and proairesis, intention, choice, often translated by Rufinus, liberum arbitrium, so free will. For instance, in De Principis, Preface 5, in the Adic Expression, etc. I skip, this is very interesting, but of course, this is just to say it's so prominent in Origen. So in theology and cosmology, free will is the mark both of God the Trinity, who is defined by Origen, libertas ingenita, so libertas freedom, non-generated, ungenerated freedom. This is the definition of God the Trinity, Homilies on Leviticus, and of God's creation. God's creation also. God, he says, created everything, including matter for him, is creatio nihilo, out of free will, not by necessity. So it's also the mark of the creation, of God's creation. This is why creatures perfected by God are indicated by Origen as libertas caritatis, freedom of agapic love. This is the name. So it's both the name of God and the name of rational creatures. They are both said libertas. They are freedom. So just to say, from the perspective of Origen, maybe not from our own perspective, ethically speaking, but from the perspective of Origen, amicably speaking, the doctrine of freedom, the concept of freedom, is absolutely necessary, is absolutely, I would say, so important, so central to all of his theory, of course, ending up with the theory of apocatastasis. So there is the centrality, I would say, of this doctrine of freedom. So this is why we can call Origen and Gregory of Nyssa theologians of freedom, the theology of freedom. So Origen's doctrine of rational creature is also marked by his theology of freedom from its beginning, so the doctrine of creation of rational creatures. As I mentioned, they are called libertas caritatis. Origen thought that rational creatures were created as independent substances, so as distinct from their eternal forms in the mind of God, and they were created as independent substances from an act of free will. Of course, God's act of free will and rational creatures' act of free will. So Origen often calls this movement, speaking of the movement of will of rational creatures, meaning so a movement of the soul, a free movement of one's will. So according to Origen, rational creatures became independent substances out of a movement, was also used by Bardeisen, for instance, in their own choice, which determined their own nature. So it's a free will, it's freedom that determines one nature. This is very important in commentary on John. So free will or self-determination shapes the nature and the relevant body of everyone in this world and in all worlds. Free will determines the nature of everyone, he says. Commentary on Romans 8 is arbitri libertas naturam fecerit uniquique. So again, it's really the free will is really freedom that determines one's nature. It's not one's nature that in a way shapes freedom or brings about freedom, but freedom is first and then it determines one nature, because after every judgment then rational creatures have a kind of body, have their place in the world, etc., as a result of their own free choices. So free will remains forever. This is even more important in rational creatures. Even after death, and at the eventual apocatastasis. This is what Origen says in Commentary on Romans. He says, we strongly affirm that rational nature will always keep its free will. Manere quidem natura rationabili semper liberum arbitrium non negamus. But, he says, Christ's sacrifice is so strong that it will save all creatures in all ages. And this I quoted earlier, speaking of the importance of Christ in apocatastasis. But still, again, the work of Christ goes together with rational creatures' free will. And this free will remain forever. It is never erased. And this is also why they will finally reject evil and adhere to God. Free will shall remain forever. It is compatible with the eventual universal restoration. In the telos, the end, human free will, instead of being dispersed in a multiplicity of minor or apparent goods, shall be oriented towards God alone and will stably remain there. This anticipates, by the way, Maximus the Confessor's theory of ever-moving repose, kinetostasis. This, I think, is one of the many elements that actually from Origen went into the thought of this great other giant, Maximus the Confessor. So repose, because it is finally stable in God, but ever-moving, because free will, the free movement of the soul, will never be alienated from the rational creature, as Origen already maintained. So, again, in Origen's perspective, only God is substantial and immutable good. Rational creatures, through their own free will, can become worse and even opposite powers, so demons, but can also return to the good. So, really the power of free will, right? It can turn to different outcomes. And by means of reason, rational creatures choose the good and avoid evil, and are thus worthy of praise or blame if they do the opposite. This is in De Principis 313. Clearly, as was maintained also by Baldeisen, as mentioned earlier, free will, in Origen's view, grants rational creatures accountability in this and the other world. With the Odyssey always in mind, which is a pivotal tenet of all of his thought, from theology to exegesis to soteriology and eschatology, Origen often insists that rational creatures' moral choices and intention, the proairesis again, determines what they will become. I'm quoting from the Principis 3.1.23. So, due to their proairesis, choice and intention, some rational creatures advance from a worse to a better condition, others fall from a better to a worse one, and yet others are preserved in virtue or even ascend from good to better. So, Origen claims a lot, I would say, and some small points still, it's very important. Origen claims really strongly that free will is attested by Scripture, and he says this extremely frequently. He says that Scripture often supports this free will of rational creatures. So this is revealed by Scripture itself. And following, again, both Scripture and Plato, as he does many times, Origen claims that free will is the source of evil. So not matter, not matter. Of course, because for the sake of theodicy, if we ascribe evil to matter, then we say that God made matter. This means that God created free will. That God created evil. And so this would be clearly in opposition to theodicy. This would, in a way, defeat theodicy. So Plato, indeed, inspired theodicy, as I mentioned, with his declaration, important declaration, the Myth of Air, that the responsibility for evil lies not with God, but with the human agent who can appropriate virtue. Plato elaborated on this notion also as well, so not only in the myth of Er in Republic 10, but also, for instance, in Laws 10, also the law, I am quoting Plato, he says, the soul is the cause of all things, therefore we attribute to it the principle of good and evil, of what is noble and what is disgraceful. And of course, so neither God nor matter cause evil, but the human soul. The insightful reader of Origen, Nissen, again Gregor Nyssa, will frequently repeat this. He quotes a lot Plato and Origen, I remember him both. He says, for instance, in Demotus, but many other places, he says it is not the body that produces the principles of evil, but free will. So again, it's neither the body nor God, of course, out of a principle of theodicy supported already by Plato, but it is free will. So this is, again, the centrality. They are always speaking of free will, of self-determination. Now I'm saying very little, but if you go through their works, they are always insisting on that. So Origen relied on Plato's definition of virtue as a despoton, something without master, and God as not responsible for evil. He says, for instance, virtue in Republic 10, virtue is something that admits of no master, a despoton. Each one will have more or less of it by honoring it or not. The responsibility is with the person who chooses it. God is not responsible. Again, so this crucial passage was already cited by the so-called Middle Platonists and was appropriated by Christians from Clement of Alexandria onward, and proved all important to the theology of freedom of Origen's follower, Nissen, and I have also a specific article in Modern Theology on this. So the centrality of human free will in Gregory is mainly a heritage of Origen, this is what I argued for. According to Gregory, there is in us, I'm quoting from the Amnesia Opificio, so there is in us the principle of all excellence, all virtue and wisdom, and every higher thing we conceive. But preeminent among all is the fact that we are free from necessity and not subject to any natural power. This was, of course, against fatalism, Stoic, Gnostic, and Manichaean fatalism. In the time of Gregory, there was already also Manichaean determinism, fatalism. So Gregory maintains that the human being was created similar to God, he says, Theo Eides, and therefore it is endowed with free will, just because it's, the human being is in the image of God. This is why it is endowed with free will, because God is free. So if God is free and we are the image of God, we are free. So they have the aut exousion. And also without master. So of course they go together. One has free will and so one has no master, a despoton, in the sense that it could not be induced to anything with an irresistible constriction. This is, again, the centrality of free will. Gregory attributes this notion of a despoton, a without master, to the human being, so citing Plato received by Origen, in at least 24 passages in his work. So it's very much insisted upon. So mostly in connection with the virtues. He stresses that the Holy Scripture places above all the desiring movement of our soul towards the invisible beauty of God. Gregory took up from Origen his notion of proairesis, so intention, choice, which was in turn influenced by Stoic philosophy. It was actually a Stoic term mainly. So he maintained that through proairesis we create ourselves. This in the Vita Moiis. This again a very Origenian idea in light of what we have said. Later it was developed also by Origen. So this means that we determine our nature through free will, although we ontologically, of course, remain creatures of God. Although also the incipit, the beginning, very beginning of the Demotus, reflects on the importance of human voluntary choices, especially that of experiencing evil in a post-Luxarian state. I am quoting Gregory. He says, since all humans have a natural inclination towards the good, because of this, the incapacity to evaluate what is really good usually produces all of their error. For if the authentic good, and this is again tenet of ethical intellectualism, if the authentic good were clear to all, prodelon pasin to aletos agaton, we would never miss it. So if it were clear to all, if all knew that, we would never miss it. Ukane keinu pote diemartomen. Thanks to the nature that is goodness, and would never voluntarily experience evil, if things were not hewed by a superficial appearance of good. So again, it's the deception of the appearance, and one can choose what seems, what looks good, what seems to be good, but is not good. And this is an error of judgment. This is a lack of knowledge. So this shows the import of ethical intellectualism for Gregory. Knowledge of the good produces our sticking to it. So this is also one of the factors of apokatastasis. They were sure, if we finally can know the good, we will choose the good. There is no other way. They also say good is self-attracting. One could argue that there are different, as I mentioned at the beginning, there are different conceptions of freedom at stake here. Ethical intellectualism on one side and today's idea of freedom on the other. Again, it is an emphatic opposition. In other words, the opposition between the ancient perspective, a historical take, and a more systematic perspective we can elaborate now. So we must not confound the two and maybe raise terrible discussions about nothing, oppositions about nothing, when the opposition is only emic-ethic perspective. So humans are made to love God, I'm quoting, made to love God freely. This is Gregory of Nyssa, following Origen's argument in his anti-Gnostic polemic. Far from being deterministic, he's one of the great exponents of what I call the theology of freedom. And again, the theology of freedom brings about, finally, the doctrine of apokatastasis. They are not so. It's not that freedom, in a way, is opposed to apokatastasis, but in their perspective, it's just because of freedom that we will finally reach the good and we will adhere to it.
Thank you for joining us in this episode of Grace Saves All. You can help spread the word by sharing this podcast with others and by giving it a rating on iTunes. If you want to find out more about David, or if you'd like to leave him a message, go to his website, davidartman.net. In the meantime, let's work together to help a hurting world know about the greatest news ever announced.